Welcome to Behind the Health Statistic. My name is Ricky Hellier and I'm a lecturer at Cardiff University School of Healthcare Sciences. Today's podcast is a two-parter where my colleague Andy Parry will be speaking to Mike Weir about his family's experience of renal disease and renal transplantation. So what is a renal transplant? Well, a renal or kidney transplant is essentially the transferring of a kidney from a healthy person known as the donor into somebody who's got little or poor renal function. The kidneys are really important within the body because what they do is they filter waste products and they convert them into urine, which we then wee out. If the kidneys lose this ability, these toxins can build up and this can cause serious illness and be potentially life-threatening. This loss of kidney function is known as end-stage chronic kidney disease or kidney failure. Now, what you can do is if this does occur, you can partially replicate the function of the kidney using a blood filtering process known as dialysis. However, this is really inconvenient, as Mike will talk to you about, and can be very, very time consuming. So a kidney transplant is often the choice of treatment for people with this disorder. Unlike many types of organ donations, you can donate a kidney while you're alive as you only need one kidney, but you can also receive a kidney from somebody who's died and their family and them have decided to donate. According to NHS BT, around about 4,500 people are currently waiting transplantation. And as of September 2020, around about 1,200 to 1,300 people have received a transplant in the UK. So let's go over to Andy and Mike and listen to their discussion.
Hello, everybody. My name's Andy Parry. I'm a nursing lecturer in Cardiff University. And today I'm talking to Mike Weir about his experiences of life following, before and following sort of renal transplant as well, and his son having a renal condition. So thanks for talking to me, Mike.
You're welcome.
So tell me, I know that Harry, your youngest son, how old is Harry now?
So Harry will be 9 in October. Yeah, so in a couple of weeks' time. Yeah.
Okay. So he's had some renal issues and sort of ongoing. So before that time, can you tell me what life was like before you had any suspicions?
Yeah, I mean, life was, I guess, typical as it is for most people, you know. So I had a full-time, fairly stressful job. We already had an elder son who would have been 5 and a half when Harry was born. You know, pretty much sort of, you know, he went to school every day, we went to work every day, sort of pretty, you know, average kind of non exciting life, if you like. Pretty sort of typical parents with one child. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. So Harry was born and so obviously when the tiny little baby's not often that they show anything that's the matter. So he was, as a baby, how was he like?
Yeah, so as a baby, I guess the only thing that really sticks out in the mind was when he had just been born, he did actually sort of stay in hospital for a little bit longer than expected. Mm. And part of that was an issue around constipation. Right. So essentially, when you look back on things, and hindsight's a wonderful thing, when you look back on things, you kind of, you know, maybe start to think, oh, well, that could have been the first sign that there was maybe, you know, a few issues here or there with something. Because, you know, as we latterly found out, constipation is one of the indicators of potential kidney issues. Although there's lots of different indicators, you know, and added all together, I guess you find yourself in the worst possible situation. But it is one of those indicators, and it's probably one of those things we look back on and say, well, you know, maybe it was a condition that he was born with that presented itself at that point.
Okay. So brought him home, obviously, and his constipation seemed to be resolved. What followed that made you and Karen suspicious?
So realistically, he was okay. You know, he wasn't sort of, you know, for the first, I guess, probably 12 months or so of his life, he didn't seem to sort of have any particular major issues. And he seemed to be sort of, you know, sort of perfectly normal. There was nothing to arise any suspicion at that point. I think probably the winter period between him being a year old and 18 months was probably the first time where we started to think, well, hang on, he seems to be getting a lot of infections, a lot of viruses.
Right.
And so I guess that's the first thing that aroused a suspicion, because it almost seemed to be sort of every week you'd get an infection, you'd be given antibiotics, and then within a week or 2 weeks he'd have another infection. And you kind of, you know, you probably went through a 6 month period over that winter where, you know, he was just, you know, predominantly he was ill rather than well most of the time.
So
that's kind of where, you know, we started to, I guess, be known as well to, obviously, to our local GP. And sort of, you know, being regular touch with those professionals, and you know, that led us to really sort of pushing it to try and find out why, you know, he was ill so much.
Yeah, it's fair enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
Kiddies do get ill quite often, but
yes,
say the frequency becomes a bit.
So I mean, eventually, after a bit of pushing and shoving, we were referred to a local paediatric specialist in our local hospital in the Royal Glamorgan.
Yeah,
and he was very much a general paediatric consultant, so he didn't have any particular specialisms, but just dealt in, you know, trying to get to the bottom of any particular issues. And I guess Harry was around about the age of two by this stage. And at the start of all of that, because of sort of constipation issues and various illnesses, they immediate thought was that maybe there's something wrong with his thyroid. So we did have a consultation with somebody in the Heath who specialised in that side of things, but that didn't bring back any results. And then on one particular occasion, when Harry was probably about 2 and 3 months, he was admitted to the Royal Glamorgan with an infection, and at that point they managed to take a urine sample from him.
Right.
And that was what identified that he was leaking protein from his kidney.
Okay, so it was almost sort of incidental and a sort of accidental discovery in some ways.
It was almost that. Yeah. So as I say, he was admitted and onto the ward in the Royal Glamorgan, and you know, they just happened to be able to get a urine sample, which, as you can imagine, for a 2 and a bit year old, chasing them round the room. Yeah. Spraying everywhere with a bowl is good fun, but they analysed that, and as I say, that's when they realised he was leaking protein through his urine, and that's when he was referred to a paediatric kidney specialist in the Heath, and our consultant is still our consultant now, sort of seven and a bit years later.
Okay. So what was he diagnosed with then?
So the formal diagnosis then didn't actually happen until he was three.
Okay.
So we got referred to the paediatric kidney centre. Obviously, they went through a number of tests trying to work out what was wrong. And essentially, they couldn't really sort of, you know, put a formal diagnosis in before doing a biopsy.
Right.
So literally, I think it was the week before his third birthday, they arranged for that biopsy to take place. And after that, the results of that, he was given his formal diagnosis, which is a chronic condition, kidney condition called focal global glomerular sclerosis.
Okay.
Which is a bit of a mouthful, but FSGS for short.
There we are. That was easier.
And obviously, you know, chronic condition in terms of it doesn't get better, it just gets worse.
Yeah. So after that diagnosis happened then, you know, there's, I guess you've got to sort of start thinking about this and accepting it. And that, and sort of, I'm guessing a lot of appointments afterwards. So tell me how life changed after that diagnosis was made.
It's quite difficult to explain because I guess you just deal with it at the time. And, you know, traditionally, my wife has worked with a very understanding employer, and she also has worked part-time. So again, for the most part, she would have been the one that have sort of taken most of the strain, if you like, in terms of those appointments. So essentially, post-diagnosis, all it really meant was that we increased the regularity of appointments. So typically, at that point, it would have been once a month.
Okay.
And Harry was also prescribed with medication. And that medication was essentially designed to try and halt or slow down the decline in his kidney function, right, which at the point of the biopsy was actually at 75%.
Okay.
So yeah, all it really meant in terms of a daily change was medication for Harry, which was given in liquid form, which was obviously easier for him to take. And a monthly appointment, and those monthly appointments would typically be, and they still are now, would typically be a check of height, weight, and blood pressure, and then a blood sample would be taken, and you'd take a urine sample, and they would analyse those and effectively see if there was any need to change the medication, or whether there was any need to take any further treatment.
Okay. So quite worrying times though, to be, you know, those tests being taken and the results coming back.
Yeah. I guess from a non-medical background, and you know, we consider ourselves very lucky in the consultant that we found ourselves with, who's, you know, given us lots of information, you know, always relevant, always thinking about, you know, Harry and how he's doing, and, you know, a real sort of empathy for the condition and also, you know, for what everyone's going through. So I guess we've always been very lucky that we've been able to rely on his guidance.
Yeah.
Because as non-medical professionals who've never been through something, you know, none of us have ever had any medical issues ourselves, you know, you're kind of a little bit in the dark in terms of what things mean and what how things are interpreted and what that means for treatment, etc. So we were very lucky. I mean, for example, you know, what tends to happen is that Harry will, they'll analyze those samples, and we'll get a phone call the same day, typically later the same day.
Yeah.
And he will go through those results and tell us if there's any changes required and why. So I guess, you know, we didn't need to think about that side of things too much. And I guess also probably thinking back to it at the time, when somebody says, yeah, your kidney function is 75%, you probably kind of think that's all right.
Yeah. You know,
that's not too bad. That doesn't sound too bad.
Yeah,
you know, so you're probably a little bit blasé about it, to be honest, because obviously at that stage they didn't know how quickly his kidneys would decline.
Right.
You know, they were just hopeful that they could keep going as long as possible.
Right. Okay. So how quickly did his renal function decline then?
So yeah, so he's had his biopsy at age 3, and broadly, 2 years later, his kidney function, for really unknown reasons at this point, started to decline fairly rapidly. So just before his fifth birthday, I think we were down to sort of 50%.
Okay.
Then maybe a month later, we were down to 35. And then probably a month after that, we were below 20.
Okay, so very rapid then.
Yeah, and so, you know, below 20, as we understand it in terms of renal patients, that's when they start to think about other things, other treatments. So essentially at 5 years of age and 3 months, he did have a round of chemotherapy,
okay.
Which essentially was seen as the last opportunity to try and sort of kickstart his immune system and start to fight the kidney disease.
Okay.
And at that point, his kidney function was down to about 18%.
Right.
And I guess, you know, you do get little rainbows of light and the hospital, you know, the children's hospital do some fantastic things. So he happened to have his chemotherapy the day that the Cardiff Blues squad were visiting the ward. So he got to have his picture taken with Sam Warburton and, you know, whilst he's having his chemotherapy. So, you take the small wins.
That wasn't a bad day then.
Not for him.
No.
I mean, it's interesting you say that because, you know, one of the things I always say is that if you take the children's hospital as an example, it is full of children who are just kind of playing and sort of almost, not really sure what's going on or not necessarily feeling too many ill effects from their treatment or what they're going through. And next to them, you've got a load of parents who are absolutely worried sick.
Yeah.
But generally, I mean, you know, whenever Harry's been admitted to the ward in the children's hospital in Cardiff, that, I mean, even now people remember him from that ward of being an absolute nutcase.
Yeah.
Just running around everywhere, you know.
He's lively.
Us constantly saying to him, you know, you are meant to be ill, Harry. You know, just sit in the bed for 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so what made a difference to you guys on the children's ward then? Who were the people that made a difference and what did they do to make that difference?
I think, I think there's some very good healthcare professionals there. As I say, I can obviously think of a couple where even if, so if Harry has an issue now, what tends to happen is that we would ring that particular renal ward in Cardiff and they would, or our consultant if we can get hold of him, and they would direct us as to what to do. And bearing in mind, Harry really now hasn't been admitted for quite a long time.
Yeah.
They all still remember him because he was such a character, you know.
Yeah.
So I think there were particular staff that had a real sort of empathy and a real sort of caring side to their work, if you like, and they really enjoyed what they do. They really cared about the patients, and that kind of shone through.
Yeah.
You know, even the way they dealt with Harry and the way they played with him, and they, you know, and obviously, you know, it's great that we have got a designated children's both hospital and kidney unit.
Yeah.
You know, on our doorstep, because you know we have had times for it. For example, his biopsy was done in the adult side of the hospital.
Yeah.
And the whole experience of him being anaesthetized and taken away from you was, you know, I mean, that was the first time we did it. You imagine it's horrendous.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were only allowed to take, only one parent could go in with him when he was anaesthetized. So, you know, Karen opted, my wife opted to do that. I'm then sat in a waiting room, not knowing what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
And then she's obviously comes out in floods of tears.
Yeah.
And then you've got to wait around for 2 hours until somebody rings you and tells you he's okay.
Yeah.
You know? And it was just, it was horrendous.
Yeah.
But if you then transfer that to the children's hospital when he had his subsequent operations, you know, we were both allowed in with him. You know, the anaesthetist told him that he was going to give him the hedgehog medicine, which was going to be like milk you give to hedgehogs and then they go to sleep. And it feel a little bit prickly going up his arm.
Yeah.
And you know, it put you at ease. So we are very lucky to have that facility so close to us, and as I say, to have the renal department as well.
Yeah, it is an important thing, isn't it? So did Harry have dialysis at all?
Yes, so he had that round of chemotherapy. That was a real up and down week because we booked to go to Lapland for 3 days. We then got a call from our consultant saying we need to do the chemotherapy. So we disappeared to Lapland and had a fantastic holiday for 3 days. And then 2 days later, he had his chemotherapy. And at that point, as I say, we were also told that his kidney function was at 18%. And, you know, again, in hindsight, you're thinking, really, should we have gone away? But, you know, obviously we didn't know it had declined that much at that point. So,
no.
So he had that in December, and unfortunately that didn't work. And in January, then he was admitted to hospital in formal kidney failure.
Yeah.
Where his function at one point in that week was down as far as 8%.
Right. Okay.
So then you're into a whole different conversation about what's next.
Yeah.
So we found that quite difficult to deal with because not only are you dealing with a situation where your son's not very well and you're, you know, you're fearful of what's going to come next.
Yeah.
But you also get lots of healthcare professionals and indeed other professionals who are interested in talking to you about their part in the next steps and what that means.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there in complete shock thinking, well, yeah, I just need to process this.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, I'm still getting phone calls from work saying, you know, well, you know, I know he's in hospital, but when are you going to be, when do you think the idea might be that he's going to be out, you know, when are you going to be in the office? You know?
Yeah. That's helpful.
Helpful. Yeah. I mean, as I say, I've not been as lucky as my wife has in terms of having perhaps a more understanding employer.
Yeah.
So to be honest, that was just a massive kind of shock and a massive, so people are just giving you masses of information and you're kind of like, well, you know, I just need to step away from this. Can you just, you know, so what needs to happen now?
Yeah.
And where do we go from there? So essentially the main headline from that was that we, upon suggestion from our consultant, opted to go for peritoneal dialysis, which essentially can be administered from home. And that was kind of for us the kind of easiest way, rather than the other way of hemodialysis, where he'd have to go and sit in the hospital for 3 mornings a week for around about 4 hours while he dialyzed at the hospital. So they were happy for that to be the treatment, and it kind of meant that, you know, we could live a semi-normal life around sort of schooling and work, etc., etc.
Yeah.
So that treatment there, the main thing was a surgical procedure to insert a catheter, so that then he could undertake peritoneal dialysis at whatever point he was ready. And again, what they suggested is that, you know, ideally they'd like that catheter to settle in for up to 8 weeks before they had to use it, because it needs to settle in and seal itself and have time for the body to adjust before they actually use it in a serious environment.
Yeah.
So he actually managed. His kidneys managed to last up until probably about 3 months later. So he had the catheter fitted, and it was then about 3 months later that we were told that we really need to start now.
Okay.
And he formally started dialysis.
Right.
And again, that was disruption, because what that meant was effectively staying in hospital for 2 weeks, more or less, while they started the dialysis to see how he reacted to it. And then my wife was trained on how to use all of the equipment, so that when he came home, we could do everything from the house.
How was that on her, having to learn to do that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it was. I guess it was daunting at first. A lot of what's involved is really just about making sure you're in a clean environment.
Yeah.
The scary bit is that your son's got a tube coming out of his stomach, and every night you've got to go through a procedure in a sterile environment as you can, where you're connecting him to that machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where it gets kind of scary, because you're actually at the point where you're administering a medical procedure.
Yeah.
The cleaning stuff, you know, it's a hassle. We had to make extra room in the house to put all the equipment in. You know, it kind of took up half of our spare space in having monthly months worth of dialysis supplies in the house at any given time.
Yeah.
But the real scary bit was when you connected him every night.
It's not something you would have associated with, you know, yourself or Karen would have associated with being a parent, is it?
No. No, absolutely. Yeah.
That wasn't part of the contract, if you
that
like.
Wasn't, you know, neither us. Although, you know, Karen is in early years education and therefore has a leaning towards caring for the younger children, albeit not in a necessarily a healthcare environment. Yeah. But yeah, nonetheless, it's not something you expect to have to undertake. And as I say, that was definitely the scariest bit for me, was actually that point at which you're connecting him up.
Yeah.
And the machine starts running.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I could understand that. It's easy to see that, really. That would be.
And again, all through this period, he's also on a different set of medication now that he's on dialysis, which, you know, to effectively make the dialysis work as well as it can.
So there's new stuff for you to learn all the time with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And one of the good things, the machine comes with a modem fitted, and so the machine sends the results back to the hospital every day.
Right.
So that they can see what's happened. So the machine effectively runs overnight, 7 days a week, and it runs for about 10 hours overnight while he's asleep. And then the machine sends the results to the hospital the following day in terms of how it's worked during the night.
Yeah, that's useful.
Yeah.
One sort of weight off your shoulders, if at all possible, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you said, I mean, you know,
the only downside of the machine is obviously it has a set of alarms, which essentially you've got a line which goes from the machine to your son, and being, you know, just like anyone, as he moves about during the night, during his sleep, he then starts lying on the line, and the line thinks, oh, something's gone wrong, and off go all the alarms. So so sleep was pretty tricky.
Right, okay. Yeah. like you say, it's you know, it's difficult when you're working a night shift as a nurse, let alone, you know, you've been up all day having to try and have a normal life and having to wake up, yes, to that all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And kids we were both
working, so, you know, right, we take it in turns generally, so it would be like a 4 nights on, 3 nights off pattern.
Okay, so you had an off duty going.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, one of us, that was the implication of the dialysis, because we were never sure how he was gonna react and when the alarms were going off. What we actually did was we put another bed in his bedroom,
right,
and one of us used to sleep in there with him.
Okay.
4 nights on and 3 nights off. Yeah.
Okay.
So right.
So that changed the household quite a lot.
Changed the dynamics. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, you also then I know people have arranged these sorts of things, but you are also restricted, obviously, on movement.
Yeah.
So, you know, whereas you might have thought let's go for a 2-night break somewhere, you know, as a family, when you analyse all of what you've got to do in terms of taking the machine with you and kind of all the supplies you've got to take, you think, well, by the time you get there, it's not going to be worth it for that sort of time. And I guess, you know, we restricted ourselves to staying in the UK where we could take the machine with us, and everywhere what we booked, we made sure there was a good sort of mobile signal, and you know, they weren't liable to power cuts and things like that. But
there's a lot to think about.
Yeah. Yeah, water supply, you know, clean water supply, sanitation, being clean, sterile environment, you know, just all of these things you've got to think of rather than just getting in the car and saying, should we go away this week, you know.
Yeah.
And as I say, I know people do go abroad and they arrange for the dialysis equipment to be there ready for them to use. But we decided, you know, we were best just hootling off for an hour.
Yeah.
Somewhere, and you know, we always felt that we'd like to not be too far away from the hospital.
Yeah.
Just in case something went wrong.
Okay. Well, that's, you can understand why you think like that.
Yeah.
You know, so how long did that dialysis work, if you like? What happened next after that?
Yeah. So. This was explained to us up front, and I think it is really relevant to us, you know, as a concept. But dialysis really is just keeping you alive in that strictest sense. Yeah. So it's not really giving you a life, but it is keeping you alive. And that was our experience really for Harry. Because, you know, it was difficult from a family perspective. As I say, you know, we were restricted on where we could go. He was restricted in terms of bedtimes and start times in the day because he had to be on the machine by a certain time every day.
Nice.
And obviously there was the impact of, you know, sleeping in different rooms. Obviously neither of us could go out for a night together because we were the only two who knew how to use the machine. So, you know, if we did arrange to go out, it would just be one of us, you know. So if somebody had a birthday party or something, just one of us would go.
Yeah.
So all of those sorts of things, you know, you are living a totally different life.
Yeah.
I think so that was from a family perspective, that you know, it was quite restricted, even though that was probably the easier of the two options. It was still quite restricted in terms of what you couldn't do.
Absolutely.
And from a treatment perspective, so Harry eventually stopped passing urine.
Yeah.
As a result of the dialysis, he developed a typical trait, which is like a metallic taste in the mouth. So So right. Everything that you eat tastes of metal, right. Essentially. And that led him to being in a situation where he didn't really like to eat.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you sat down to dinner at 6 o'clock, he would probably still be halfway through or less at 7 o'clock.
Okay.
With you having had to sit there and shove a fork in his mouth,
yeah.
Essentially. So he just didn't want to. He just didn't want to eat anything. And as I say, stop passing urine. He also, because of the dialysis, you are up and down a little bit with fluid restrictions. So obviously, what the peritoneal dialysis is doing, it's pumping you full of dialysis fluid in and out overnight, which obviously then the body sometimes thinks, oh, I'm a bit dehydrated today, or the next day we think, oh, I've had too much fluid, and that can then build up. So you're having a regular analysis through the hospital of what he can and can't do.
Yeah.
And, you know, towards the end of his treatment on dialysis, you know, I think he was on a really low fluid restriction during the day, which effectively meant you were telling him he couldn't have a drink, you know, even if he was thirsty.
That would be very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. Because one of the things they used to do to help him was they used to leave some of the dialysis fluid in his stomach during the day.
Yeah.
So the last cycle the machine would do would leave some of the fluid in him, which would obviously then help him dialyze during the day.
Yeah.
Which would help him to last a bit longer and you know, be a bit more active. But obviously the consequence of that was then that he then had to restrict the fluid intake, because he couldn't have too much fluid.
Okay.
So. And I guess that's one of the things throughout, is that at that stage, particularly on dialysis, you know, your approach changes quite often.
Yeah.
So they'll look at the results from the dialysis and they'll go, oh, he's dialyzed too much or too little, or he's dehydrated, he's not hydrated enough. So you're quite often you're in a weekly sort of conversation about where his levels are and whether he needs to drink more or drink less.
Yeah.
And obviously there are certain foods as well that can trigger off issues. So, you know, we were told to again, pre-dialysis, it was kind of, you know, don't eat too much chocolate, don't eat too many potatoes.
Yeah.
Those sorts of things, and then the diet then changes when you go on to dialysis, because it's a different treatment, and you know, so things are kind of changed fairly liquid.
There's a lot of adjusting and learning, isn't there, for you both to do?
Particularly at the same time, as I say, I'll go back to it again, you're trying to hold down a full-time job, and at the same time you know, you're also trying to keep life as normal as possible for another child, an elder child.
Yeah. Liam, Harry's brother, how did he cope through all of this?
Well, being, you know, he's now 14, and a typical 14-year-old, you don't really get too much out of him in terms of what he's feeling.
Yeah.
But
he's a bloke.
Yeah. Absolutely. So the honest answer is we probably don't know, but I mean, there has bound to be an impact. I mean, I recall a number of examples. So, you know, we were due to go out for Liam's birthday 1 year, and how Harry's kidney issues tended to present themselves and they still do now, if he's struggling a little bit with his kidney function, he would suddenly say he's got a headache.
Okay.
And then typically within half an hour he would be vomiting.
Yeah.
And he would then vomit for probably about 2 hours.
Yeah.
And then he would sort of go to sleep and then probably either the following morning or a couple of hours later, if it was in the day, he would just wake up and as if nothing had happened and start running around again, you know. But that was how his kidney issues tended to present themselves. And so we had this birthday organised. We were going to go out to eat, you know, somewhere for Liam's birthday, you know, an hour before we go. Harry starts complaining of a headache and starts vomiting. And obviously the whole thing then's kind of cancelled. Being a typical child at the time, he suggested he was more than happy with the substitute of going out for dinner, which was a takeaway from McDonald's.
Yeah.
But you know, so he kind of put a positive spin on it.
Yeah.
I think that one of the times that really got me is when Harry was admitted with kidney failure, and obviously we weren't sure what the future looked like at that point. And I was typically staying in hospital with Harry for most of the day. One of Liam and Harry's grandparents would then pick Liam up from school, and then I would probably go home about 7-8 o'clock to see him for a couple of hours before he went to bed. And he, in that week, he did start to say he wanted to sleep in the same room as me. And one particular night, he just came straight out with it and asked me if Harry was going to die. And that was incredibly difficult. And it still makes me emotional when I think about it now, because, you know, obviously you're trying to put a positive spin on anything, but at that point there was that possibility.
As a child, he read the situation.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, mum and dad aren't there. Harry hasn't been home for 4 or 5 days. You know, what the hell's going on?
Yeah.
So he knew it was serious, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I ended up sort of making a joke about it in terms of, you know, watching them. I'm sure they'd be racing each other, you know, down at celebrity scooters when they get to older age, you know.
Yeah.
But it was a really difficult thing to deal with. And as I say, I still get emotional talking about it now.
Yeah.
As something to deal with. I guess the only other thing really in terms of disruption for Liam was, as you know, we tried to keep things as normal as we could for him. But, you know, we have relied thankfully on some very helpful friends. You know, he's absolutely sporting mad, and probably 4 or 5 nights a week he's out playing sport of some description, and obviously we have relied on other people to be able to sort of take him and pick him up for those sorts of things. And the only other situation I remember is that actually in the week he was due to sit his SATs, Harry was he was in hospital having started dialysis. And I came home as usual, you know, we were trying to keep life as normal as possible. At 11 o'clock I get a phone call from Karen saying that this was, I think, on the second or third night of dialysis, that Harry'd had a seizure, which we believe was brought on by kind of the dialysis kind of kick-starting him a little bit in terms of that kind of kidney function. And he had 3 seizures in total in that first sort of 2-3 weeks. And then he hasn't had one since, which is where we believe the link came from. But in terms of trying to keep things normal, and this is one of the things that probably takes its toll on you eventually, is, So I got a phone call 11 o'clock saying this had happened, rang my mother-in-law. She came down to the house, slept on the sofa. Liam had already gone to bed at this stage. He was fast asleep.
Yeah.
I then went to the hospital, sat up all night with Harry. And then 7 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning, I left the hospital, came home, sent my mother-in-law home, and, you know, got up with Liam as if nothing had happened.
Yeah.
And sent him off to school. Which obviously for me was, you know, was pretty tough going.
Yeah.
But that's the sort of thing we wanted to do to try and make his life as normal as possible, really.
Yeah.
Particularly as he was sitting his sats that week as well. So
Exactly. Well, you know, it's, and that's where the pressures come from, isn't it? It's sort of trying to keep it all sort of as normal as possible, like you say.
Yeah. I mean, the only other thing I think Liam feels maybe that he missed out on a little bit, and you don't know what you what you've got till you've had an experience of it, is just before all of, you know, Harry's real decline, we had a fantastic summer holiday, 2 weeks in Menorca, and Liam was at the age where he kind of met a few boys of his own age, and it was all in confined. They had a good swimming complex in the hotel, and, you know, they couldn't go outside of the hotel, but, you know, he met a bunch of mates, some of which we're still in touch with now, and he had a fantastic 2 weeks of his first bit of freedom and a holiday abroad in the sun, you know, where he could do what he wanted to. But and I guess he feels maybe he would have liked to have done that again, but, you know, we haven't been able to because of Harry.
Yeah.
You know.
So tough times.
Yeah.
So
we, as I say, we've made a point of trying to keep everything as normal for Liam as we possibly can.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
And that concludes part one of this podcast. Please tune in to listen to part two.